celebrar ahora la audiencia en el caso 12.254 de Víctor Saldaña contra Estados Unidos sobre admisibilidad y fondo del caso. Tenemos programada una hora para la realización de esta audiencia. Tendrán primeramente 20 minutos los peticionarios, luego 20 minutos para el Estado. Los comisionados formularemos las preguntas que parezca pertinentes y luego tendrán tiempo adicional para responder las preguntas y también formular algunas observaciones adicionales que les parezca necesario realizar. Le doy entonces sin más la palabra a los peticionarios por 20 minutos.
Buenas tardes. Gracias. Los peticionarios pensamos utilizar nuestros 20 minutos del siguiente modo. Voy a comenzar yo con 8 minutos, haciendo un análisis específico del caso 12.254. Mi nombre es Juan Carlos Vega, soy apoderado de Víctor Saldaña, el condenado a muerte. Soy apoderado de la mamá de Víctor Saldaña, peticionaria también. Y coyunturalmente soy congresista argentino, diputado nacional argentino. Pero está de más decir que vengo como abogado. A mi lado está el profesor Jonathan Miller, que es mi copatrocinante, en este caso, como en tantos otros de derechos humanos, Southwestern University. Y a mi derecha está la cónsul en Houston, Valeria González Posse. Vamos a dividir, repito, 8 minutos, 4 minutos y 8 minutos. Comienzo yo. Esta petición tiene varias particularidades, señores comisionados. A pesar de tratarse de un caso de pena de muerte, cuando formalizamos la petición ante la comisión, tuvimos mucho cuidado de decir que ni defendíamos la inocencia del peticionario en el crimen atribuido, ni cuestionábamos la legalidad de la pena de muerte en el estado de Texas. Es decir, que nuestro objeto procesal fue la discriminación racial en el sistema judicial más garantista del mundo, que es el de los Estados Unidos. Tamaña afirmación debió ser muy bien fundada y debe ser muy bien probada para tenerla por seria ante la Comisión Interamericana de Derechos Humanos. O sea, aquí lo que estamos hablando es de la discriminación racial en el sistema judicial americano. ¿Cómo el sistema juzga de un modo legal a una persona que es blanca y diferente si es latina o negra o pertenece a las minorías? Pero esto no es un discurso político, ni es una afirmación filosófica ni poética, sino de que es jurídico. ¿Qué pasó con Saldaña? Primer juicio. En el primer juicio, Saldaña fue condenado a muerte en el estado de Texas y fue medida su peligrosidad futura. En el estado de Texas, una vez declarada la culpabilidad, se mide la peligrosidad futura en virtud, en esa época, de un protocolo aprobado por la comunidad científica de Texas. Ese protocolo introducía tres preguntas: joven o viejo, varón o mujer y raza, para medir la peligrosidad futura. Y de acuerdo a la peligrosidad futura, venía o no venía la condena de muerte. Ese protocolo hoy no existe y esa sentencia fue declarada nula por la Suprema Corte de Estados Unidos de Norteamérica. Esto hay que decirlo frente a los representantes del Estado. Estas son las virtudes que tiene el sistema americano: poder modificar conductas violatorias de básicos derechos humanos. Segundo juicio. Como consecuencia de esa sentencia nula, Texas tuvo que hacer un segundo juicio. En ese segundo juicio no apareció directamente la discriminación racial, pero sí apareció en toda su magnitud la secuela de la discriminación racial. Porque ya no se le hacía estas preguntas sobre peligrosidad futura a Saldaña, sino que se estaba juzgando a un demente, era un Víctor Saldaño que aparecía en este juicio después de 8 años de death row en Texas, con un nivel de degradación mental absoluto, y el juez, que era su obligación medir la capacidad procesal de Víctor Saldaño, después de haber pasado 8 años en el corredor de la muerte, no lo hizo. Entonces se juzgó y se condenó a un hombre que estaba degradado mentalmente por su permanencia en el corredor de la muerte, permanencia ilegal en el corredor de la muerte, porque les recuerdo que la Suprema Corte había declarado ilegal esa primera sentencia. Es decir, que la discriminación racial aparece de nuevo en este segundo juicio. Hoy, esa es la situación que tenemos. Las pruebas. Señores comisionados, los abogados pocas veces tenemos tantas pruebas y de tanto valor para sostener lo que decimos. La prueba de la discriminación racial en el sistema judicial americano proviene del propio sistema judicial americano. Es la sentencia de la Corte Suprema de Estados Unidos de Norteamérica quien nos da la razón al declarar nulo el primer juicio por discriminación racial. Un abogado de cualquier país del mundo, con cualquier estándar, no necesitaría más pruebas para pedirle a la Comisión que declare a Estados Unidos que ha violado elementales derechos humanos consagrados por la Declaración Americana, específicamente el 18, específicamente el 26, y a través de ellos el artículo 1 y 2 de la misma declaración. Para terminar, Saldaño hoy lleva 13 años en el corredor de la muerte. Su nivel de degradación mental es total y absoluto. Era un hombre sano cuando entró. Les recuerdo, nunca defendimos la inocencia de Saldaño. No creemos de que el sistema haya probado su culpabilidad, pero nosotros nunca la defendimos. Tampoco nunca atacamos la pena de muerte. Estamos hablando de algo enormemente importante que son las garantías judiciales para las minorías en el sistema judicial más garantista del mundo, como es el de los Estados Unidos de Norteamérica. El presidente Obama está en el poder. Su discurso es de compromiso con los derechos humanos. Más allá de lo que diga la Comisión, a quien le pedimos una urgente decisión por la cual se haga responsable Estados Unidos de las violaciones a la Declaración Americana y se dispongan las reparaciones necesarias. Independientemente de eso, le pedimos al Departamento de Estado que contemple la posibilidad de que se abra una vía de solución amistosa para ver si podemos enderezar este vicioso proceso judicial impregnado de discriminación racial. Gracias.
Thank you. I have been asked to address you in English. I am from the Argentine Consulate in Houston. And from December 26, 1995, when we were alerted by the court-appointed attorney of Mr. Saldaño's detention, we have been visiting regularly Mr. Saldaño and have observed a profound mental and physical deterioration as a result of Mr. Saldaño's time in death row. Mr. Saldaño was initially serving his sentence in Huntsville, where inmates within a maximum security regime were allowed social contact, recreation, and attendance to religious services. All of this changed in March of 2000, when Mr. Saldaño, along with all death row inmates, were transferred to the newly built Polunsky unit. There, no physical contact or communication between inmates is possible. The isolation is total and extreme. The cells measure 5.4 cubic meters, square meters. That is a room of 6 by 10 feet, including the built-in cot, laboratory, and toilet. This tiny space is enclosed by a solid door that reinforces the isolation. Under this regime, a year later, by 2001, Mr. Saldaño had suffered an abrupt change in his mental aptitude followed by his first suicide attempt. He also experienced a weight loss of over 20 kilos. At the time, disciplinary actions by prison authorities left Mr. Saldaño unable to receive visits, no access to limited recreation, no access to the prison store, and during prolonged periods, he was subjected to a cold diet consisting mainly of peanut butter sandwiches. After his first suicide attempt, Mr. Saldaña was transferred to the psychiatric hospital for several months. This will be the first of 9 hospitalizations. Since his first crisis, his mental problems never stopped and led him to a self-destructive attitude where he was unable to maintain the most minimal and elemental hygiene and regularly refuses food. During his trial in 2004, Mr. Saldaño again displayed clearly bizarre actions. He refused to change out of his prison garb. He masturbated inside his pants in front of the jury. He was distracted, looked disheveled, smiled inappropriately, moved his lips without emitting sounds, and was unable to assist his lawyers in his defense. In our view, it is hard to understand how clear signs of a mental illness that had been previously documented by a physician from the state psychiatric unit were dismissed by the court. In 2006, Mr. Saldaño suffers a new severe breakdown and is again hospitalized, this time for the 5th time. For several months, he is incoherent and has difficulty in understanding simple phrases. Dr. De Leon from the psychiatric hospital informs the consulate that Mr. Saldaño has been diagnosed as suffering from a schizophrenia since his behavior of hearing voices, smiling in an irrational manner, and moving his lips in an intermittent way without emitting any sound were clear signs of this disorder. This is the first time that the prison authorities recognize Mr. Saldaño's mental illness in front of consular officials. But this conduct was not new. This same conduct had already been made evident during his second trial in McKinney, Texas in 2004. 2007 brings new suicide attempts when he tries to hang himself with bedsheets. While Mr. Saldaño is at the psychiatric hospital, he receives medical attention, is under a less strict regime, and some improvement in his condition is evident. He later decompensates when he is transferred back to the Polumsky unit. The Argentine consulate continues with its regular visits to Mr. Saldaño and continues to witness the physical and mental deterioration of Victor Saldaño as the result of his time on death row and as evidenced by the visits and medical documentation to such an extent that it's difficult to recognize him as a person. Thank you.
Thank you. And I'm going to address the legal arguments primarily presented by the U.S. government. First, the requirement under international law is that the status quo ante be restored in the event of a serious violation of international law like the racial discrimination that took place at the first trial. In fact, the Inter-American Court has gone even further in the Hilaire case to directly say that in cases of serious procedural violations, there shouldn't even be a retrial. The status quo ante clearly was not restored in this case. We're dealing with a situation whereby the second sentencing trial, the decline was so pronounced he simply wasn't able to assist his attorneys, and worse than that, he was scary to the jury. And one of the issues that the jury must address in Texas is future dangerousness. How can a jury correctly address future dangerousness if they're faced with someone sitting at the defendant's table who's masturbated, who's disheveled, who's distracted, and they don't hear a word about why? The basic approach of the United States government in this case seems to be that the protections of the U.S. Constitution and the U.S. court system are sufficient. Well, this is a case where it was only because of the Argentine government that the practice of having expert testimony associate race with future dangerousness was ended in Texas. The psychologist who testified at the original trial said in the transcript that he testified in some 70 cases. Not all of those would have been cases on the issue of future dangerousness, but we know of at least 8 other cases that were reopened as a consequence of the press from this case. This case came to the attention of the world thanks to an Argentine legislator who was present at the trial and an Argentine consulate that pushed for a direct appeal on the issue, in spite of the fact that there was no objection presented at trial. Rather, there was cross-examination on the issue of whether Argentines are from the same bloodline as Mexicans and therefore represent the same future danger. The district attorney from that case, when I called him to the stand at pretrial in 2004, continued to insist that it wasn't racism. It was just scientific testimony that had been earlier presented. The Court of Criminal Appeals, when I appeared before them after the 2004 trial, began their questions to the prosecution with the question of, isn't this case like the story of the son who kills his parents and pleads for mercy that he's an orphan? That was the first question out of the mouth of the Court of Criminal Appeals judges to the prosecution. Today, the United States government is offering habeas corpus as a solution, but it's really a fig leaf unless we get their direct support. The odds of being successful in habeas corpus today in the Fifth Circuit are around 5%. The vast majority of those cases that are successful aren't cases involving the sentencing stage. They're cases involving the guilt or innocence case stage. The standard for habeas corpus is the need to show that the decision below was unreasonable. It's a very, very high standard of proof. Only about 5% of habeas corpus cases get an evidentiary hearing. We need an evidentiary hearing if we're going to have any hope of success. It's true, as the U.S. government briefs argues, that U.S. law bars the execution of persons who are incompetent. Unfortunately, Texas has now placed Victor Saldaño on a medical regime that does give him some periods where he's lucid. So what am I to do now as an attorney? Am I supposed to advise Victor Saldaño, along with his other attorneys, that he should stop taking his medication so that once again he's no longer lucid? And believe me, the best way for Victor to face the endless days in a 5.5 square meter cell is with medication. He wants that medication. This case was extremely politicized in Texas. There was an open battle between the Attorney General of Texas, who conceded error in the initial case, and the Court of Criminal Appeals. Both Court of Criminal Appeals judges, several of them at the time, and the Attorney General were running for election. The Attorney General ran successfully for election to the Senate, and the Court of Criminal Appeals judges faced battles for re-election. They're still upset with this case. They found all the major issues presented to have been procedurally defaulted, even though there was no procedural rule that was violated. And at this point, the only way there's any opportunity to get relief at the habeas corpus stage is if we get assistance from the U.S. government with an amicus brief to try to convince the court to grant us an evidentiary hearing. This is a case where the racial discrimination was never overcome, because while a second trial was provided for, a second trial under circumstances where the person is said to be a future danger based on misconduct during his last three years on death row, because a full day of testimony at the second trial was testimony by prison guards of how he acted out on death row in ways that wouldn't have occurred if someone wasn't in severe isolation. That's not restoring the status quo ante. The only way to restore the status quo ante at this point is by converting the sentence to life imprisonment. We're very open to the commission offering its services to try to facilitate a friendly settlement in this case. Because the racism hasn't been cured, the Argentine government has done what it can to try to cure the racism at the trials. But unfortunately, to date, it's been a rather futile effort. Well, futile partially, of course. 8 other cases were reopened. A law was passed, thanks to pressure from the Argentine consulate, eliminating the use of race in death penalty sentencing in Texas. In the event that the U.S. government is unwilling to take concrete steps now to assist Victor, then the most appropriate action for the commission would be to decide the case on the merits, perhaps in combination with a visit to the death row in Texas, so the commission can appreciate firsthand the conditions under which Victor Saldana is being held. Thank you.
Agradezco a los peticionarios por su presentación. Tiene la palabra por 20 minutos la representación del Estado de Estados Unidos.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Distinguished commissioners, the government of the United States appreciates the work of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights and firmly believes that the commission's function remains a vital part of our Inter-American system. With this in mind, we are pleased to participate in today's hearing regarding Case 12-254, Victor Saldana. I am Andrew Stevenson, alternate U.S. representative to the United States, of the United States to the OAS, and also joining me today in representing the views of the United States government are Gwen Kinsey, Deputy Chief of the Capital Case Unit of the Criminal Division of the U.S. Department of Justice, Gilda Brancato of the Office of the Legal Advisor for Human Rights and Refugees of the U.S. Department of State, Andrew Shepard, Office of the Legal Advisor for Human Rights and Refugees, also U.S. Department of State, and Ms. Chaz Holm of the U.S. Mission to the OAS. Mr. Chairman, the U.S. mission to the OAS is fully committed to advancing Secretary of State Clinton's call to renew America's leadership through diplomacy that advances our security, enhances our interests, and reflects our values. Our participation in today's hearing is a clear reflection of this call. The United States is also pleased to extend to the commissioners and the Executive Secretariat staff of the Commission very warm congratulations upon the 50th anniversary of the Commission. Regional human rights bodies and monitoring mechanisms, such as the Commission, give civil society, especially human rights defenders, an established and accepted channel to communicate human rights concerns to governments and encourage regional attention and cooperation on human rights situations. Distinguished commissioners, in making our statements this afternoon, the United States underscores the importance which we attach to the international and the inter-American community addressing the critical human rights situations of our day. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm now pleased to pass the microphone to Ms. Gilda Brancato of the Department of State's Office of the Legal Advisor. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Commissioners, good afternoon. Petitioner and everyone assembled present, good afternoon. I will present the first part of the United States government's response to the petitioner, and then we'll turn the case over to my colleague from the Department of Justice to address the matters raised by petitioner. Of course, the U.S. government has listened very carefully to the presentation today. We've read the papers and the petition that has been filed. And certainly, the United States expresses compassion for the difficulty that you've expressed today on behalf of the petitioner. But with due respect for this difficulty as a matter of law, the United States takes the firm position that where there is available strong constitutional protections, including the availability for the first time of an ongoing federal habeas petition to address the allegations that are claimed about the 2004 hearing, that the American Declaration is respected and the rights are respected through strong judicial guarantees and oversight in the federal judiciary. Petitioner certainly claims that Articles 1, 2, 18, 25, and 26 of the American Declaration have been violated. Each of these rights is fully protected under United States Constitution and laws and through the mechanism of providing the remedy of the writ of habeas corpus. As I listen to the heart of petitioner's presentation, we believe it is that essentially the 2004 hearing did not cure the allegations and the violation found by the United States Supreme Court and by the federal habeas court in an earlier proceeding stemming from the 1996 hearing. The United States does not dispute that the 1996 hearing was tainted by racial discrimination. Of course, the case found its way through the state and federal court system, and the Supreme Court remanded the case for the Texas Attorney General's confession of error, and through federal habeas proceedings on the 1996 death sentence, that was vacated. The heart of the petitioner's claim of a new allegation is the 2004 hearing. The United States listens carefully to the claims, to the errors of law cited by petitioner, and notes that it wasn't until October 26th of 2009, last week, that the petitioner availed himself of the federal habeas corpus remedy to challenge the conduct of the 2004 hearing. Therefore, the petitioner has just initiated this robust, independent federal judicial review of the claims they said that tainted the 2004 hearing. As you know, we reject categorically that the habeas corpus proceeding is a fig leaf. There's a strong, robust federal judiciary. Earlier in this particular case, the Supreme Court and the federal judiciary vacated the earlier death sentence. If new constitutional errors have occurred, the federal court is equipped with the expertise, the constitutional background, and the competency to give petitioner the relief that he alleges. Here, as we mentioned, the federal habeas petition, which is 170 pages, just filed last week, raises several of the claims raised by the petitioner before this proceeding. In addition, there are affidavits, of course, providing a factual basis for the fact that there were errors alleged by plaintiff in the 2004 hearing. Principal errors being alleged by plaintiff that the court did not sua sponte entertain a competency hearing, and also that the court improperly rejected the evidence offered by their psychiatrist and refused to provide appropriate guarantees for a competency issue. But each of these claims have just now been brought before the federal court. The federal court has the opportunity to address them, to give an evidentiary hearing, and to provide any appropriate relief under our constitutional system. I will turn over the case shortly to my colleague from Justice to give further specifics and illustrations of the strong protective role played by federal habeas. We think that the petitioner can't, on the one hand, laud our strong, robust judicial system with which we agree, and then say it's a fig leaf and it's hollow and cannot give relief. In fact, in earlier cases before this commission, in the juvenile justice case of life imprisonment without parole, there's also some concern that the likelihood of relief within our domestic judicial system was very improbable. And of course, as you may know, on Monday, our Supreme Court is entertaining oral argument on the constitutionality under the Eighth Amendment of imprisonment without parole for crime committed by a juvenile. So we reject that the remedies are hollow and empty. The remedies were just initiated last week. There's a full hearing or a full, excuse me, proceeding before the Federal District Court. Then there are limited rights of appeal, both to the Court of Appeals of the Fifth Circuit and the Supreme Court. And we believe that it's a principle, as outlined in our brief of international review and adjudication, that the domestic courts, independent and robust, should be afforded the first opportunity to recognize a violation and grant relief. The 2004 hearing, which is the heart of the petitioner's claim, has not yet been reviewed by a federal court. There is an opportunity, if wrongs have been committed, to right them. And so we would like to underscore the importance of this habeas relief for the proceedings to be allowed to go forward under our federal system, particularly with all the constitutional protections that are afforded. Many are outlined in our submission, particularly in regard to the mental disabilities claimed by the petitioner. But I now turn to my colleague from the Justice Department to express, in particular, and to answer any questions about the federal habeas protections applied to petitioner. Thank you.
Good afternoon, commissioners, counsel for petitioner.
Oh, I'm sorry, and others present. I have very little to add to what Ms. Brancato has stated. other than to emphasize the following, and that is that no federal court, the petitioner is challenging his death sentence that was imposed in 2004, and no federal court has reviewed, had an opportunity to review the claims that are raised with regard to that sentence. The defendant in the petition, the habeas petition that he filed in federal court last week, has raised all of the claims that are raised before the commission here today. He's raised his incompetence. He's asserted his incompetence at the time of his 2004 sentencing. He's raised, challenged the evidentiary rulings that were made at that hearing in terms of admitting evidence that was offered by the government and excluding evidence that was offered by the defense. The defendant has also raised and argued his the violation that he alleges resulted from his detention in the current restrictions that he's under, and his accompanying loss of mental health. And that's in claim 9 of his petition. So all of these claims that are being raised before the commission here today are raised in the federal court for the first time. Counsel for petitioner does not argue that the federal courts have been ineffective in what they've in their prior rulings in this case. In fact, it wasn't just the Supreme Court, but it was also the Federal District Court in Texas that granted him relief. It was the federal court where he's filed his petition now that set aside his death sentence, his prior death sentence. So that's not an ineffective venue for him. Federal habeas corpus, and this is an initial federal habeas corpus, and I think that's a very important point. Second habeas petitions of a challenging a sentence or a conviction are treated in a totally different way. But this, for purposes of Mr. Saldana's death sentence, 2004 death sentence, this is an initial federal habeas, and the Supreme Court has stated that. The United States Supreme Court has stated that although state court rulings in state capital cases or non-capital cases are considered carefully, they're not rubber stamped by any means. They are given, a federal court has a firm duty to exercise its independent review and judgment on federal constitutional claims. And in that respect, it's been stated already, we have a dual system for reviewing convictions and sentences in the United States, and one is you have your normal appeals, which go through the way an appeal typically would, what we call direct appeals. You have a trial, and then you can appeal to an appellate court, and then to another court. But we have a backstop system, which consists of a separate federal judiciary, totally independent of the state where the sentence and conviction was imposed. And those are life tenure judges who have no prior contact with the case, or no prior dealings in the trial or in the prior appeals in the state system, and they those judges jealously guard their ability to review and their independent jurisdiction over these cases, and those obligations are discharged very diligently and with great integrity. So we request, in the past, this commission has had this proceeding pending before it for a number of years. We have allowed the federal system to, the appeals of the initial conviction and death sentence to become exhausted. The federal courts granted relief in this case. He's now been sentenced to death again. And for the first time, the petitioner has raised a petition challenging his death sentence imposed in 2004, and we respectfully request that the commission allow that process to carry itself out as it did with regard to the prior conviction and sentence. Unless the commission has any further questions, we'll submit with that.
Muchas gracias. Vamos a hacer entonces una ronda de preguntas para que respondan primero los peticionarios. Vamos a hacer una ronda de preguntas para que respondan primero los peticionarios y luego los representantes del Estado. Comisionado Piñeiro, que es el relator de la Comisión para Estados Unidos, primeramente.
Muchas gracias, señor presidente. Quería en primer lugar saludar los esfuerzos del Estado argentino, los representantes de Argentina en seguir ese caso. Creo que es una un comportamiento que merece saludos en términos de la lucha contra la discriminación. Quería también agradecer todas las informaciones que el distinguido representante de Estados Unidos trajeron para esa conversación, para esa reunión. Desde el día que leí ese caso, estaba me preguntando qué termo diplomático iba a utilizar para me referir a ello. Yo creo que es un caso emblemático. Es un caso iconic, que en inglés eso es muy bueno, y icónico. Porque en los últimos 6 años que estoy aquí, tengo acompañado varios casos de pena de muerte, pero no recuerdo un caso de que en concentrado estén tan presentes, y no voy a repetir toda la argumentación porque debemos pensar en el futuro, no solamente en calificar el caso, pero que están presentes la discriminación, el diálogo del fiscal con el experto, es una cosa extraordinaria. Estaba preguntando si en la categoría categorización de razas, ¿dónde se sitúan los argentinos? Estaba me preguntando, ¿dónde se sitúan los brasileños? Nosotros nunca fuimos hispánicos, hay un problema. Y dices, no, los argentinos deben ser considerados hispánicos. Y eso como garantía de periculosidad futura. Pero eso fue superado por las grandes garantías del sistema jurídico americano. Pero el segundo es la discriminación de alguien con severa situación psiquiátrica. Creo que eso fue ciertamente, como los peticionarios presentaron, fue agravado por todos esos años mantenido en ese cubículo. Lo que quería preguntar a los peticionarios en esa visión constructiva, después de toda esa longa acción en el sistema jurídico americano. Primero, la proposición que ustedes mencionaron de la posibilidad del Estado federal se asociar a apoyar el pedido de habeas corpus. Si usted podría elaborar un poquito más eso, le agradecería. Y para el distinguido Estado, representante de Estados Unidos, hubo una proposición de una solución amistosa para ese caso, teniendo en cuenta toda la demostración de buena voluntad de todos los oradores que aquí participaron de esa reunión, y teniendo en cuenta esa concentración de casos de trazos tan negativos en ese caso, si el gobierno no podría meditar sobre la posibilidad primero de apoyar lo que está siendo propuesto por los peticionarios, apoyar como Estado federal con todas esas grandes esperanzas que están depositadas hoy en el gobierno federal, o también considerar esa posibilidad de un diálogo en una solución amistosa. Muchas gracias.
Commissioner Roberts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I'd like to express how refreshing it is to have the United States participate without reservation in this case, and that is certainly a refreshing development. I want to ask the petitioners, I'd like to hear from the petitioners, their response to the submission of the United States, but you have not exhausted domestic remedies as a matter of admissibility of this case.
Yo quisiera hacer una breve reflexión y a partir de ello algunas preguntas. Si bien el caso presentado ante la Comisión, desde luego es uno solo, ¿no es cierto? Está concatenado en sus distintas partes. Si he entendido bien lo que han querido decir los peticionarios y el Estado, pareciera que hay alguna fase respecto a la cual hay acuerdo en la evaluación que se hace y otra en la que no hay acuerdo. y sería lo siguiente: en la que me parece que hay acuerdo es en el hecho de que sobre la base de un perfil racial se discriminó al señor Saldaño, por lo cual estuvo preso en condiciones que deterioraron su salud durante varios años. En lo que hay desacuerdo respecto a la situación actual y si debieran o no los peticionarios continuar presentando recursos a nivel interno de Estados Unidos, y en ese sentido si debiera o no pronunciarse la comisión en este momento. Ahora, respecto de esa primera etapa, en la que, como digo, mi impresión, y corríjanme cuando intervengan si estoy equivocado, es que hay acuerdo entre las partes, me pregunto si respecto de eso, ¿cuál es la evaluación que se tiene sobre una eventual reparación al respecto? Los peticionarios han planteado aquí, de manera más general, por cierto, no se han referido solo a esa etapa, pero esa es la que hay acuerdo, por eso yo quisiera preguntarle al Estado cómo analiza esa etapa en términos de una eventual reparación por esa discriminación racial que ha sido reconocida por el propio Estado en su intervención, y que si bien en esa etapa fue subsanada por la decisión de la Corte Suprema de Justicia, no tuvo un efecto retroactivo, por así decirlo, para las condiciones de deterioro de la salud mental que ya había experimentado el señor Saldaño. Entonces, en ese sentido, me gustaría escuchar a la delegación del Estado. Ahora, por otra parte, me parece que es relevante aquí resaltar el carácter de órgano semijudicial o cuasi-judicial que posee la Comisión Interamericana, y en ese sentido para la Comisión es de la mayor importancia poder alcanzar persuadir a las partes a alcanzar soluciones amistosas. Es la manera más eficaz de hacer efectivos los estándares del sistema interamericano, y en ese sentido quisiera escuchar con mayor detalle a las partes en qué términos se podría dar una eventual solución amistosa, cuyos términos, por cierto, tendrían que ser discutidos, si habría reconocimientos de responsabilidad, si se haría por razones humanitarias, no sé qué satisfaría a cada una de las partes en ese sentido. Hay muchas maneras de llevar a cabo una solución amistosa, y desde luego los estados las asumen bajo distintos supuestos, en distintas circunstancias, y son muchos los casos que se resuelven de esa manera en la Comisión Interamericana. Considerando tanto la cuestión de la discriminación racial ya reconocida, que ocurrió por lo menos en una época, se discute la situación actual, y el deterioro a la salud mental que objetivamente ha tenido el peticionario, y que la víctima presunta, y que los peticionarios señalan que se debe a esa situación que ha vivido. Le doy entonces la palabra primeramente a los peticionarios. Comenzamos. Tenemos 7 minutos para los peticionarios y 7 minutos para el Estado.
Thank you very much for your questions and for your analysis. And to begin, I'd like to focus on the help that we need in the federal habeas. I only received the U.S. government's response yesterday, so I can't give you detailed statistics on the success of habeas corpus. But the fact is, it's very bleak in the Fifth Circuit. We're dealing with really one of the most conservative circuits in the United States. The federal district courts in Texas are very conservative. And what we need is a hearing. The mental condition of Victor Saldaño has never been examined by a court. The standard in habeas corpus is that there has to have been unreasonable conduct below. It's a very hard standard to reach. And so very few habeas corpuses are successful anywhere in the United States, but particularly, of course, in the parts of the country that are most conservative. Now, in terms of what that would mean for reparations, our primary goal is to keep Victor Saldaño alive. To be honest, I think it would be a tremendous achievement for this commission to be a vehicle through which petitioners in a case like ours, where there was gross racial discrimination that has never been remedied because as a practical matter, the status quo ante was not achieved. And in a case like ours, where a foreign government was instrumental in ending a pattern of race discrimination, this is the kind of case where the Commission could help influence an outcome where the U.S. government does what it does have available to it, which is to participate with an amicus brief in the federal habeas corpus to try to convince the court to give us an evidentiary hearing, because that's what we need, an evidentiary hearing. Regarding exhaustion, I don't think there's much doubt that remedies are already exhausted here. After 13 years on death row in Texas, most of them under the conditions of the Polunsky unit, the suffering needs to stop. This case is exhausted because of how much time has gone by after the initial death sentence. And in terms of the effectiveness of habeas corpus and the effectiveness of the prison system, of the court system, it's striking that the initial concession of error by the state attorney general was in the year 2000. Had this case been heard again in 2000, Victor Saldana would not have been the person with gross mental decline. By 2004, we're dealing with a person, who it's just a sad, sad case of the degradation that had occurred by then. Let me turn to Juan Carlos Vega to continue.
No sé si tenemos tiempo todavía. Lo mío es muy sencillo, muy concreto. Valoro mucho la presencia de Estados Unidos. Creo que realmente la importancia que le asignan al caso es emblemática, por las razones que el comisionado Paulo Sergio Piñeiro ha dicho. Este es un caso emblemático que resume en sí una problemática que afecta a muchas minorías en este país. No es lo mismo hablar de discriminación laboral, de discriminación política, que de discriminación en el sistema judicial. Somos absolutamente conscientes que estamos tocando una de las joyas más preciadas del Imperio Americano. En términos de absoluto respeto lo digo, porque soy un admirador del sistema garantista de los Estados Unidos, pero es un sistema que lo hemos visto funcionar con una política de doble estándar, claramente. No sabemos cuántos casos Saldaña existen. Nos consta que en Texas existen al menos 8 casos que fueron juzgados con ese protocolo científico, entre comillas, donde se pedía la pregunta sobre la raza para medir la peligrosidad futura de una persona. Sabemos que la Comisión Interamericana es un órgano semijudicial, conocemos las limitaciones que tiene la Comisión Interamericana para esto, limitaciones que se agudizan cuando el Estado denunciado es el Estado más poderoso del mundo. Somos conscientes de eso. Por eso vuelvo a decir que valoramos muchísimo esto. En cuanto a la defensa del Estado americano, que básicamente es el no agotamiento de las vías del derecho interno. Seamos claros de que en el sistema existe una excepción. Existen excepciones que podríamos perfectamente pedir que se apliquen en este caso. De hecho, las estamos pidiendo. Pero preferimos lo que los comisionados han propuesto, la vía de la solución amistosa. Aquí hay una vida que está en juego, urge buscar una decisión, y no solamente es la vida de Víctor Saldaña, sino que es el derecho de las minorías ante el sistema judicial más perfecto que tiene el mundo. Gracias.
Tiene entonces la palabra el Estado por 7 minutos.
Thank you very much, commissioners. Thank you for your time, and thank you also, Argentina, for your comments. The state has a few points it would like to underscore. First of all, again, there's no dispute about the vile nature of the testimony that was introduced at the 1996 hearing. I think everyone in this room would agree with that. We, though, depart from the petitioners in that we believe that that violation, that constitutional violation, was remedied through the appeal to the United States Supreme Court, which there was, of course, direct appeals, then appeal to the United States Supreme Court. It takes a few years for cases to work their way through the judicial system. But that racial discrimination was remedied through the Supreme Court remanding the case through the confession of error by the Texas Attorney General and the federal habeas vacating the original death sentence. So that wiped the slate clean and a new death sentence hearing was proposed. Petitioner, of course, alleges flaws, constitutional violations domestically, and violations of the American Declaration in the second hearing. And there, of course, petitioner is first bringing these constitutional flaws to the federal habeas proceeding. Earlier, the federal habeas proceeding vacated the first death penalty, and if the flaws are as petitioner describes, I don't see why he pays such short shrift to the fact that there could be habeas availability, habeas relief available. There is a standard set by the federal courts for unreasonable action by the state hearing. But petitioner more than alleges and argues in his habeas petition and here before the commission that the action of the 2004 sentencing was unreasonable. So the U.S. reiterates the robustness and sincerity of our federal remedies, the fact that this case does need its day in court. We do not see that the original violation was not remedied. It was remedied when the death sentence was vacated, a new hearing was set, new flaws are alleged with the hearing, and that now is presented for the first time before the federal courts. So I do ask the commissioners and petitioner to keep very clear the fact that there was a violation, a racist, vile violation, but it was remedied through the U.S. Supreme Court and habeas, a resentencing, also constitutional violations alleged for the resentencing, now first time before the habeas courts. Habeas is a robust review. The Department of Justice has prepared, and I would like to distribute today in further supplement of our filing, just some of the principal protections, of course, at issue here, provided by the federal habeas courses, federal habeas courts, the types of Supreme Court and federal court holdings that provide review for the precise types of allegations of constitutional violations here. So remedies are live, robust, and should be allowed to pursue their course. But I would very much like to address the friendly settlement. We also, of course, are cognizant that there is a life at stake. We haven't got into our discussion of the death penalty, of course, because petitioner has not disputed the viability or the lawfulness of the death penalty. And as you know, we take the strong position, I think, undisputed, that the death penalty, as administered in the United States, is subject to strong constitutional protections and is not inconsistent with human rights obligations of the United States under, for example, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, Article 6, to which the U.S. is a party. The U.S. is not a party, of course, to the American Convention, not bound by the jurisprudence of the American Convention. But that aside, because I think both sides agree that the death penalty is not unlawful as administered by the United States, but we are dealing here with allegations that this death penalty imposed in 2004 was unlawful, and they're seeking friendly settlement. As I understand it, friendly settlement has been proposed by Argentina through their request that the United States government submit a statement of interest, an amicus brief in the federal habeas that has just been filed last week. They have pursued their case. In fact, there was a high-level meeting within the State Department on their request. There was a second meeting this morning. It is a request that has been proposed just within the last few weeks and is being very seriously reviewed by the State Department. As you know, of course, filings in federal court are approved and made by the Department of Justice. And so this would need to be a joint decision by the Department of Justice and by the Department of State that this is an appropriate case for federal intervention. As we've told the government of Argentina and representatives here today, it would be an extraordinary intervention. Generally, the federal government does not intervene in cases of federal habeas, particularly in the district court for the first round of review, by a state prisoner against state authorities where international treaty obligations are not at issue in the habeas petition, where the conduct of the State Department is not at issue, or the conduct of the Justice Department not at issue. It's an extraordinary request, but one that we're taking very seriously. I also want to, of course, point out the constraints on the United States in a friendly settlement. To the extent, you know, that this is an authority, it is a state authority that is detaining petitioner and a state authority that will be defending the habeas case. You know our considerations of federalism, that it really is the federal court and the state authorities that have the potential to grant petitioner relief. That's why I think they very wisely couch friendly settlement in terms of intervention in the federal habeas, because that is the really avenue to provide relief. The commissioners know all too well the difficulties that the federal government has had with state authorities on death penalty cases, even when we have a treaty obligation. Of course, I'm addressing Medellin and the consular notification cases. So the realistic approach would be through the federal court proceeding, through a grant of relief from the federal courts. The U.S. government will very seriously consider the request for intervention. It would be an extraordinary matter, but something that it will be looked at very seriously. And again, underscoring that there is a life at stake, but of course there was a petitioner who was convicted of murder, sentenced to death, the first death sentence vacated, and now the second death sentence, the flaws alleged, under review in our federal habeas. And so the U.S. believes that the availability of robust federal remedies, coupled with the constraints of a federal system, leave our federal courts as the institution within our government to provide relief if there has been a violation. And that is currently, of course, just presented before the courts last week. I'll ask my colleague from Justice if you'd like to add.
No, I think you covered the points very well.
Bueno, la comisión desea expresarle a las dos partes que se pone a disposición de ellas para lo que pueda ser utilidad para alcanzar una solución amistosa. Valora el hecho de que haya una disposición en ese sentido de las partes y, como digo, lo he consultado con el relator también de la comisión para Estados Unidos, está a disposición de las partes en ese sentido. Levantamos ahora la sesión. Muchas gracias.